afternoon in the matter of State versus Nazir Goldsmith. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Assistant Deputy Public Defender Ashley T. Brooks on behalf of Mr. Nazir Goldsmith.
Good afternoon, Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Good afternoon, Assistant Prosecutor Rachel Lamb for the state.
Welcome, counsel. Ms. Brooks, please go ahead.
I would like to reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal. I'm also going to actually waive the 5 minutes that I had originally reserved for an opening. This case is about a man unconstitutionally stopped and frisked because he was present in an area the police believed was high crime. Mr. Goldsmith did not do anything suspicious. The police were suspicious of him because of the area he was in and the house he was near. When an officer's perception of an area causes him to automatically view people present in that area with suspicion, officers will stop and frisk without an objective or particularized reason for suspicion, based on nothing more than speculation, generalizations, based on nothing more than a hunch. This is exactly what happened in this case. There was no individualized basis for suspicion, and therefore the stop and the frisk were unconstitutional. I'm going to address both the constitutionality of the stop and the frisk, but I'd actually like to begin with the frisk, because the trial court properly found there was no objective and specific basis to believe Mr. Goldsmith was armed and dangerous. Even if this court finds there was reasonable suspicion to stop Mr. Goldsmith, the police do not have grounds to frisk a suspect anytime they believe he might be involved in drug activity. This court has held this on previous occasions. It's not even clear that police would have a basis to automatically frisk a well-known top narcotics dealer without some additional individualized basis to believe he's armed. Even in Oates, the case the appellate division relied on to reverse the trial court's decision, one of the men had multiple bulges on his person. The observed bulges provided the primary basis for the frisk. It was cited before the court discussed the fact that it may be reasonable to think that a top narcotics dealer known and targeted by the federal authorities would be armed. In Arthur, this court cited Thomas, which had analyzed Oates, for the proposition that an officer might be justified in believing that a substantial dealer in narcotics could be armed and dangerous. So while it may be debatable whether or not there would be reasonable suspicion to frisk a known top narcotics dealer, what is clear is the police do not have authority to automatically frisk someone whenever they have a hunch or even a reasonable suspicion to believe he might be involved in low-level drug activity. To frisk someone, the police must have specific reason to believe he or she is armed and dangerous. Even if this court credits the officer's testimony that the area was known for weapons, and I'm going to discuss the high crime area factor more in depth in a moment, this court and the Supreme Court of the United States has been clear that this consideration does not provide an individualized basis for suspicion. Mr. Goldsmith had to do something to make the police believe that he was armed and dangerous. It's not enough if he was in an area in which weapons are common. So the only possible grounds for individualized suspicion for the frisk in this case included Mr. Goldsmith's nervous behavior and his request to not be searched. Neither of these factors get the state to reasonable suspicion for the frisk. As this court has already recognized, nervousness is minimally probative of even generalized suspicion and does not provide a specific basis to extend the scope of a stop or to believe someone is armed and dangerous. It's understandable why certain citizens would be nervous around the police. This court can't artificially not consider race. This court should ensure that the legal standards reflect the experience of all of its citizens and find that Mr. Goldsmith's nervous behavior was not suspicious and did not provide for individualized reasonable suspicion. Mr. Goldsmith was sweating and he was looking furtively. He was not reaching for anything. He was not making any strange movements. As the trial court found, this nervous behavior observed did not give specific reason to believe he was armed. And next, it should go without saying that the police cannot rely on the person's invocation of a right as a basis for a frisk. And yet the officer ultimately searched Mr. Goldsmith because when the officer told him they were going to reach into his pocket to retrieve his ID, Mr. Goldsmith politely told the officer that he did not want him to touch him. To hold this against him would seriously undermine his and all citizens' rights. If the police attempted to talk to a suspect and the suspect politely told the police he did not want to talk to them, this could not be used against him to justify detention. And the same rationale applies here. Mr. Goldsmith's request to not be searched cannot be converted into a basis for suspicion. So for all these reasons, the frisk was clearly unconstitutional. And as the trial court found, there was no objective and individualized reason to believe he was armed and dangerous. Unless this court has any questions about the frisk, I'm going to move on to the stop.
I just have a procedural question to ask you.
Yes.
The transcript refers to a photograph that was moved into evidence. Is there any reason why this is a photograph of the house in the area. Is there any reason why that photograph hasn't been made available to this court?
Yes, well, I tried to acquire it and I was unable to. I asked the trial attorney if she had it and she did not. So that is why I did not introduce it into the record. But I think that we can gather from the transcript that...
Is there no way of getting a photograph that the trial court observed and that was part of the basis of the decision for an appellate court to review, since it's part of the record?
I mean, as I said, I did talk to the trial attorney about it and tried to get it that way. It wasn't in the file provided to me. I have, you know, the entire file. So that is why it's not introduced as evidence. And I thought that in this case that we could gather enough from the testimony to know about, where Mr. Goldsmith was when he emerged from the walkway and relatively where the police were standing. They were standing, I think the testimony was a couple of chairs lengths away from him as he emerged from the walkway. So moving on to the stop, this court should also reinstate the suppression order because the stop was unconstitutional. Just like with the frisk, even if this court considers the character of the neighborhood as a basis for suspicion, there was no individualized suspicion in this case. The behavior that the stop observed was Mr. Goldsmith walking through a walkway near other people in a residential area. Unlike in other cases where this court has found reasonable suspicion, such as in Arthur and Pinero, the police did not observe an exchange or any movements indicative of a drug transaction. All they observed was Mr. Goldsmith walking through a walkway near other people. So if this court upholds the stop, this case will permit the police to stop citizens who live in certain neighborhoods for simply walking around and being near other people. It's not suspicious to use a walkway between homes or to be near other people, and the character of the neighborhood doesn't make it so.
Do we know whether or not this was a walkway between homes? We know from the transcript that the walkway was at least abutting an abandoned house. Do we know whether or not there was an occupied residential house on the other side or across the street?
Yes. So the trial court found that there were at least two other homes on the right side of the walkway. And then there was the unoccupied house on the left side. The officer testified that he wasn't sure whether or not the houses on the right side of the walkway, whether or not there was an entrance to those backyards, but he believed there was to the backyard of the unoccupied house. But there is testimony that there were houses on both sides. And the officer admitted that he could not recall whether or not Mr. Goldsmith had told him that he lived in one of the other houses bordering the walkway. So being in an area, a high crime area, or near a house, even assuming that the house had been used for drug sales in the past, is not a particularized basis for suspicion. Police can't automatically stop everyone who passes through
Ms. a certain Brooks, walkway. May I ask you a question? The prosecutor characterized the house as abandoned, but the police officer response was vacant. Is there any indication from the record that this house is abandoned or in any way unoccupied at the moment, or was it just vacant at the moment?
The officer just testifies that the house was a vacant house, and there's nothing more said about the matter, so we don't know really what they mean by vacant or abandoned. I think that it perhaps just means that it was unoccupied at the moment, and then the abandoned language obviously has a very negative connotation, but imagine that the police were in, a wealthy neighborhood and the house was simply unoccupied at the time with a for sale sign in the window. That wouldn't be especially suspicious, right? And so we don't have any reason to think that this house was, you know, especially abandoned or suspicious for that reason. We just know that no one currently lived there. So again, a suspect's conduct must give rise to individualized reasonable suspicion. Police can't stop everyone who passes through a certain walkway or is standing near a certain house. The officer's perception of the area was the reason for the stop, and the courts heavily relied upon this factor as a basis for suspicion in this case. This court has already recognized that officers and courts need to be wary of overemphasizing the character of the neighborhood as a basis for suspicion. It should now find that this factor is not a reliable basis for suspicion and does not meaningfully contribute to the reasonable suspicion calculus. Courts have been assuming that officers are aware of high crime areas and are more likely to detect crime in those areas. So they have credited without question an officer's belief in an area's high crime as a basis for suspicion. What we now know is that the fact that an officer deems an area high crime is not correlated with high crime rates, but instead with the racial demographics of an area. And officers are actually less likely to uncover crime when they rely upon their belief that an area's high crime is a basis for suspicion. The high crime area designation is not based in evidence. It rests on an officer's inaccurate, subjective, and generalized beliefs. And not only is this factor unreliable, it invites implicit bias and results in unwarranted focus on communities of color. The large majority of people who live in these neighborhoods and are subjected to unconstitutional stops and frisks are entirely innocent. And although the constitutionality of these stops and frisks that do not result in criminal charges rarely comes before this court, the law must be able to protect both the innocent and the guilty from unconstitutional stops and frisks. This court can do this by acknowledging that high crime area designations are unreliable, speculative, meaningless, and based on generalizations. This court isn't prepared to eliminate this factor as a basis for suspicion. It should still strictly cabin its use. Our courts have generally credited an officer's subjective perceptions without question, which leaves the designation undefined and unchecked, meaningless, and subject to the influence of implicit bias. If this court was to define the factor, establish a clear standard, and require the state to satisfy that standard with objective evidence, it would push the state towards more effective evidence-based policing and mitigate the harm to certain communities posed by reliance on this factor. At minimum, this court could require an objective basis to believe that a small defined area has recently had a high incidence of a certain type of crime relative to other areas. These were the sort of factors that, for instance, the First Circuit adopted in Wright. So to satisfy the standard, this court could either require that the state provide some sort of empirical support to show the area is actually high crime, or at minimum require that the police provide a specific objective basis to establish the standard. And without a basis to satisfy it, a factual determination that an area is high crime wouldn't be supported by sufficient credible evidence in the record. In this case, there's testimony that the area is a high crime area known for drugs and guns, and that is why the officer went there. To support the fact that it's an area known for drug activity, the officer testifies that he's observed 5 to 10 drug transactions in the area sometime over the past 20 years. This doesn't appear to be a particularly high rate. A Ninth Circuit concurrence pointed out that if 32 arrests on a street over a 10-year period was high, then this would mean that most streets could be designated as high crime. So the officer also asserted that the house neighboring the walkway was known for drug activity and weapons, but he didn't say how he knew it was so known. He didn't offer any specifics. This testimony is inadequate to demonstrate that an officer's belief about the area or the house were objectively reasonable, or to show these areas had a high incidence of drug activity relative to other areas. And for these reasons, the court should assign them either no or little weight. But again, I just want to be clear that even if the court assigns some weight to the officer's beliefs about the area or the house, these beliefs still do not provide individualized suspicion to suspect Mr. Goldsmith of criminal activity. There is no basis for individualized suspicion. Even if drug activity is common in an area or drug activity has previously occurred at a house, it's simply not suspicious to walk in a walkway near that house or to be near other people in a residential community. Mr. Goldsmith's conduct was not suspicious. For these reasons, when the police confronted Mr. Goldsmith, armed in tactical gear, and blocked his path, he was unconstitutionally seized.
Ms. Brooks, can I ask you a question about that? What weight do you believe should be given in the analysis of the stop to the fact that the officers stood face to face with him when they were questioning him, which is not uncommon in many settings?
Yes. So the problem here and the reason that there was a detention when the officers initially confronted Mr. Goldsmith is because he was emerging from a walkway, a narrow walkway. And so when the officers stood directly in front of him, you know, armed and they're wearing tactical gear, and it's a secluded area that two other men had walked away, there's no one there. You know, a reasonable person upon such focused demonstration by the police would not feel free to leave. And the officer acknowledges that Mr. Goldsmith was essentially blocked from moving forward, you know.
Right. So is that sufficient in and of itself, that in a face-to-face encounter between an officer or two and an individual, the fact that they cannot move forward, is that sufficient to constitute a stop?
I think so. I think that, you know, this court's decisions in Davis and Rosario, even the dissent in Rosario, acknowledged that generally when a person is blocked, their path forward is blocked, that person is generally subjected to a detention. So in Davis, for instance, when the police cut off the people who were biking forward, or in Rosario, you know, the defendant wasn't moving, but still the defendant was unable to, or a reasonable person would not feel free to leave when the police is, you know, are focusing such specific attention on this individual. In this case, because Mr. Goldsmith was walking forward and the police are standing in front of him such that he can't move forward at that point, a reasonable person wouldn't feel free to leave. And this court should,
it's not just that, they asked him for his identification, correct? I mean, yes. So it's not that there's blocking his way. They asked him to present identification. Am I mistaken?
No, you're correct. But my position is that Mr. Goldsmith was actually seized as soon as the police blocked his path forward. And the trial court found that he was not seized until the police demanded his identification. Mr. Goldsmith did not become nervous until after the police started talking to him. So after
Ask you a question. For our purposes, why do we have to stop the analysis at they were just blocking his way? Like, why wouldn't we consider that they also said, present your identification?
So the only reason it matters is because Mr. Goldsmith didn't become nervous until after they blocked his path forward. So in considering whether or not there's reasonable suspicion for the stop, an additional factor going towards that reasonable suspicion would possibly be Mr. Goldsmith's nervousness. And so if he was stopped as soon as the police blocked his path forward, then his nervousness cannot be considered in that calculus. But if he was blocked, or if he was only seized after they demanded his identification, then it would be. But again, the nervousness is minimally probative anyways, especially in this case where, you know, like I said, there's no strange reaching movements or any strange movements, really. He's just sweating and clearly nervous. And, you know, as I pointed out earlier, it's understandable why certain citizens would be fearful.
Is it your position also that they had no right to ask for his identification? Or do you think they, go ahead. What is your position on that?
My position is that when they ask for his identification, that would be a detention. And so in order to ask for someone's identification, you need reasonable suspicion for the stop. And the police didn't have reasonable suspicion for the stop in this case. So I'm just going to briefly conclude unless there are any other questions for me. The police's generalized beliefs about an area led them to view Mr. Goldsmith with suspicion. The police cannot stop a person from walking in a walkway or for being near other people in a residential community. Nor can they search him because the interaction with armed police makes him nervous, or because he politely asked the police not to touch him. Both the stop and the frisk were unconstitutional, and the suppression order must be reinstated. Thank you.
I just have one very brief question, and it's factual. You keep on talking about it as a walkway, but the transcript also refers to it as an alleyway. Like, what is it, if you know?
So the officer later on corrects himself and he says, it's not really an alleyway, it's a walkway. It connects, you know, at least the street towards the back of this unoccupied house. And then it also is bordered by additional houses on the right side. So the unoccupied house on the left side, at least two, if not more, houses are on the right side. These are row homes. So the officer ultimately testifies it's a walkway.
Thank you, Ms. Brooks. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court. I think Ms. Brooks's presentation was terrific and I adopt what she said and I'll do my best to not repeat the things she did, but let me try and respond to a couple of the questions. There's this question, an interplay between the question you asked Chief Justice Rabner and you asked Justice Albin about when are we measuring the stop? Well, actually, before we get to that, let me first say the frisk is the easy issue. The frisk is very clear. To adopt the position of the appellate division would be to abandon decades of New Jersey jurisprudence that requires more, or at least a more specific showing for a frisk than it does for a stop. The appellate division abandoned that, abandoned what we had said in Thomas and in Arthur, and seemed to treat a frisk as a mere petty indignity, which we know it is not. That's that. On the question of the stop, however, there is a question on when do we measure it? Is it when they first blocked his path and peppered him with questions, or when they demanded ID? And so I don't think you can separate that middle piece, the peppered him with questions, from the blocking of the path. I think, Chief Justice Rabner, the best way to think about this is not when does it constitute a investigative detention, but what would it take to keep this as a field inquiry? Which is to say, when is standing face to face with someone the sort of non-offensive contact, conduct, interaction that we expect between ordinary civilians? And you're right, people do sometimes come face to face, but people don't come face to face with you typically when you're walking down a narrow alleyway or walkway, call it whichever you want, and stand and start peppering you with questions. Where are you coming from? What's your name? And so those are all, I think, sufficient indicia that he is not free to leave. The combination of the questions and the body language. And the officer is very clear in the transcript. I didn't say stop. I didn't have to. He couldn't get around me. They asked specifically, well, what could he have done? He could have turned around and run the other way. If what we want to do is incentivize people to turn around and run the other way, we can say that he's free to leave. But I think that's bad as a matter both of constitutional law and public policy, and frankly, would have been very unsafe for Mr. Goldsmith. The demand for an identification, however, Justice Albin, makes the question plain. Once they've done that, that is not the way ordinary civilians interact with each other. I've never once asked someone for ID and no less told them that they weren't free to retrieve it themselves, that I was gonna have to do it. That is the way law enforcement interacts with people within their custody or control, very plainly. So I think that the appropriate measurement is pre-nervousness, but I also think, as Ms. Brooks articulated, nervousness adds so little to the equation, given what this court has said since Tucker, that we know in contemporary urban environments, there are plenty of reasons people don't want to talk to the police and might be nervous around them. I don't have much more to say. Justice Albin, on the question of what's on the other side of the walkway, Judge Fuentes, you asked, is it an abandoned house or a vacant house? I take your point. I think there is a distinction between the two. To the extent there would be a more permissive approach in an abandoned house, the state certainly has failed to make the proofs necessary under this court's holding in Brown of what is an abandoned house versus a vacant house. But there's clearly something on the other side. And if you look at page 44 of the transcript, Justice Albin, you'll see where the officer said, look, there's a fence there and these other two houses, and I don't know if there's a gate. So in the absence of knowing whether there's a gate there, the officer seems to want us to believe that, listen, he has all this training and experience, and he knows that walkways are often used as stash locations. Perhaps walkways are also used for walking, though.
Well, we don't know from the from the transcript, what I couldn't determine is whether or not that walkway went through the backyard onto another street.
It goes into a backyard of two homes, and the officer said he didn't know whether there was a fence that impeded the walkway, because there may well have been a gate. He simply didn't know. And given the state's burden in this warrantless search case, that was something that they were required to show.
So you feel that the record here supports the conclusion that that walkway led to other residences?
I think it's crystal clear that it leads to other residences. There is a fence between them, and there may be a gate in the fence. And if there's a gate, and right there was Mr. Goldsmith's counsel asked a question. Did he tell you it was his own house? We don't have an answer from the officer. The officer didn't remember him saying that, but it certainly was a house that was occupied. And so walking down an alley, a walkway, is hardly the sort of suspicious behavior that warrants a stop.
Mr. Shalom, may I ask you a question? You acknowledge that a police officer has a right to make a field inquiry to approach a citizen and ask questions without intimidating or being abrasive. What do you suggest in this situation? What should have been the approach of the officer when he approached Mr. Goldsmith?
So given the very intimidating physical presence, physical area in which they found themselves, this narrow walkway in the dark, and they've blocked his egress, I think the way to convey to Mr. Goldsmith that this is a consensual conversation and he need not participate in it is to be affirmative. So had the officer wanted to simply figure out what was going on in the neighborhood, he could have said to Mr. Goldsmith, hey, I'd love to ask you a couple questions. You're not obligated to, but do you mind telling me where you're coming from? Or he could have rotated his body slightly so that Mr. Goldsmith could have gotten by. The chief is right that people do often talk face to face, but if one is trying to convey a message of a non-intimidating manner, you do that by turning your body and making clear that the person can pass.
Should this court consider whether there should be some kind of preface that the officer makes clear that this is just, I'm asking a few questions, you're free to leave. I just need to ask you whatever it is that the officer wants to ask them about, but making clear verbally that this is not something that he's required to cooperate.
So let me say this, Judge Fuentes. I think that would be a good practice on the part of the officer. It would clear things up. It would obviate this conversation about, is this a field inquiry? Is this an investigative detention? It would be very clear. But I don't know that the court needs a constitutional mandate in every case or even a rule in every case. But officers should know when you approach someone in an intimidating place like an alley, block their path, and start peppering them with questions, unless you take some affirmative steps like the ones that you just mentioned, Judge Fuentes, you run the risk of putting yourself into investigative detention land and needing to come up with reasonable, articulable, particularized suspicion, which the officers were lacking in this case.
Are we suggesting that the officers say this is a Terry stop, this is not a Terry stop, you're free to go and ask all those things?
I don't think it's required. I think it would be a good practice. And I don't think it's a reference to Terry, which is something that most ordinary civilians don't know. But I do think telling people that they're free to leave or not free to leave is very useful. Perhaps it's useful to say this to you, Justice Fernandez-Vina. When we do Know Your Rights presentations for the public, we tell them to ask police officers if they're free to leave, because it crystallizes the issue. Is it a field inquiry? Is it investigative detention? Officers would be well served to do the same thing to clear things up and prevent us from having these sorts of debates. But I don't think this is a particularly close question, because what you have in this case is the officer doing this kind of talismanic invocation of certain magic words, right? Say, based on my training and experience. Well, what he said was based on his training and experience is that when people are nervous, it's suspicious. So we can't allow them to base things on their training and experience when it runs counter to the jurisprudence of this court. It's just, that's not okay. And the idea that in his experience, walkways are often used as stash locations. As I said, they're also used for walking. And Demeter teaches us that saying something is often used for an illicit purpose is insufficient if we know it's often also used for a lawful purpose. In Demeter, it was film cartridges. Here, it's a walkway, but the point is the same. I promise to be brief, and I've already broken that promise. I'll try not to break any others unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shalom. Ms. Lam.
Good afternoon. The state asked this court to affirm the decision of the appellate division because there was reasonable articulable suspicion to for both the stop and frisk in this case. Based on the totality of the circumstances, which in this case was the high crime area, the officer's experience and observation, and defendant's conduct. I'm going to go through the high crime area first. Defendant keeps saying that these were generalizations of the particular officer. That's not the case in this instance. The officer was able to point to specific things that he had witnessed based on his training and experience. He knew that this neighborhood was a very high volume of weapons and drugs and shootings. And not even just this particular neighborhood, this particular street, 1600 block of Holcane. It's a four house street. It's very small. And this particular house that he saw defendant and the two individuals in front of, vacant, abandoned, the transcript cites both. We can use vacant. No one was living there is the point. And the officer knew that based on his training and experience, people traveled to that house specifically for the purpose of buying drugs.
Ms. Lam?
Yes.
When terms high crime, high volume, and the like are used, is there a specific measure? Is there a specific standard by which one can evaluate them?
There has never been precedent that requires it's any sort of empirical data or quantitative threshold. The high crime area factor is a sliding scale. A high crime area in Haddonfield is different than a high crime area in Camden, is different than a high crime area in Newark. So requiring some kind of threshold goes against the cornerstones of the Fourth Amendment reasonable suspicion inquiry, which is a police officer's training and experience based on that specific locale.
So following up on your answer, high crime may mean one thing to one officer and something different to another in the very same department describing the same area, no?
That's correct. And that's why it's important that we maintain the objectivity of the Fourth Amendment analysis. And that's also the issue with requiring empirical data. So for example, an officer knows that in the past month, there's been 100 arrests in this area, but the officer wasn't involved in any of those arrests. He doesn't know the particulars or the reason why that the arrest occurred.
Ms. Lam, can I follow up on something you just said? You said that there's a difference in what the word high crime area means, depending on the on whether it is Newark or Camden or Haddonfield. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I don't understand exactly what you mean by that.
So there are different populations, number of people living there. There's different demographics. There's, more neighborhoods that are that have more drug activity in one side of Camden than the other, or just Camden as a whole, and then another town. I mean, there's different statistics and demographics in every
city.
You're
suggesting that the constitutional right of a person varies on geography, on where they happen to be living or being at the time. So a citizen in, let's say, Montclair can feel more, has more rights than a citizen in Newark?
No,
there's not a presumption of being in a high crime area because you're in Montclair and not in Newark?
That's not what I'm saying, Your Honor, and I'll try to be more clear. Regardless of the economic status of an area or the demographics of the people who live there, there are cities in the state that have more arrests, more evidence of drug activity, more evidence of violent crime than there are in other cities or even different neighborhoods in that different city. And so I think the issue with requiring some kind of threshold or quantitative data.
So take that. We know that certain areas in our state have greater crime. There's greater crime in Camden than in Haddonfield. The question is whether or not by saying, oh, this is a high crime area, all the people in that area are going to have lesser constitutional rights. They're going to be more likely to be subject to stops and frisks because it's their misfortune to be less economically well-heeled than someone in Haddonfield. And that is the concern that I hear being expressed by your adversaries, that the use of high crime is including a whole swath of innocent people who daily go about their lives, walking the streets, and who don't want to be stopped merely because by the police, merely because they happen to live in a high crime area. Go ahead.
Well, that I think that's an issue with quantifying a high crime area in some kind of official stamped way. If an officer sees something that could be innocent, could be suspicious, but he knows for a fact he is in a designated high crime area, that gives him more reason to want to further investigate what he's seeing.
Just to be clear, Ms. Lamb, the state's not taking the position that people in some cities and towns in New Jersey have greater constitutional rights than others. Your argument is that the crime rate in a given area may be a factor, one of many, in terms of the totality of the circumstances that the officer looked at. Am I correct about that?
That's exactly right, Justice Patterson. I'm just maintaining that it is a well-established factor in the reasonable suspicion analysis.
And it's a well-established factor in federal law as well as state law. Is that correct?
That's right.
And you're only arguing that it's a factor. I just have a couple questions related to that, correct? One of several. It's a totality analysis. You're not disputing that?
Absolutely not.
Now, getting back to whether it's a factor or not, we've heard some other questions. As I understand it, Camden, which has a defined police department, like Newark, like Jersey City, like as far as I know, every city of more than a certain number of people, maybe every municipality by now, has something called crime mapping and can actually designate how many offenses happened in that alley, how many times drugs were confiscated from that house, how many times crimes of various types and police responded to them or did not respond to them in a particular street or neighborhood. That statistic and statistical analysis actually exists in certainly in Camden, I think, and in virtually every other municipality in the state. Is that right or am I wrong?
I can't speak to that specifically, Your Honor. I'm sure that some
just
or most cities,
I'm
not aware of any such statistics. I'm not saying that they don't exist. I am just personally aware.
If they do or don't exist, don't you think, would that be relevant, pertinent, or a subject of testimony, evidence, in suggesting that it is a high crime area? In other words, wouldn't it have been important to find out if there's actually any statistics available and relate that to whether that's a factor that should be considered?
I believe that that could be another useful factor in the overall totality of the circumstances. It's not about whether or not this information is available. It's about requiring it as part of the reasonable suspicion analysis.
No, I'm not suggesting requiring. I'm just saying, might that be helpful if it is in fact available?
It would be helpful. And I think that it would be another useful factor in the reasonable suspicion analysis as to whether an area is actually high crime.
Ms. Lamb, going to the facts of this case, the two police officers who were patrolling the area, the two sheriff's officers, I believe, they saw two men in front of this, let's call it an alleyway for purposes of discussion. It doesn't really matter the label we put on it. But he did not see them do anything that remotely indicated there was a drug transaction going on. He just knew, he presumed that it was something like that because of where it was happening, not what he saw. Am I correct?
You are correct that the officer did not see the defendant and the two men interacting. However, based on his training and experience, seeing defendant walk out an alleyway, which is known for drugs and weapons, stash area for both of those things, knowing that individuals travel to this abandoned property specifically for the purpose of purchasing drugs, and seeing defendant come out of that alleyway just feet from where those two individuals were. And then when the individual saw the police, they immediately turned around. So based on his training experience, a 20-year veteran, 15 of those in Camden, he understood the behavior of imminent drug transactions.
And that may be the behavior in the past, but in that moment, he didn't see any indication that a crime was committed or about to be committed. He may have had similar experience in the past. So wouldn't that give grounds for that, perhaps for them to create a stakeout or devote more resources to that area to determine whether or not that's indeed a place where people, what he called it, which is an open drug market, he used open air market of CDS distribution. He didn't see anything that day, but he believed that may be going on. That can lead to further investigation, but he didn't have any grounds to believe that anything had untoward had happened at that moment. Am I correct?
He believed that he was about to witness a drug transaction, but he did not see one.
Could he have stopped anyone in front of that house? So we know that there were two people. Could he have stopped those two people in the very same way that he stopped Mr. Goldsmith? Stop them, question them, ask for the identification, and then when they started sweating, if they did sweat, then frisk them. Based upon everything you said, high crime area, he said there were drug transactions on this street. I've seen it 5 to 10 times, what, over a year. Would that be a basis for stopping those two people? And as I said, having the same interaction that they had with Mr. Goldsmith.
Based on the totality of the circumstances, the officer could have found reasonable suspicion that those two individuals or any two individuals that he saw behaving in the same manner could be stopped.
Okay, so that leaves my question.
Yeah, he didn't stop those two, did he?
He did not.
He only stopped the one.
But you're saying that he could have. So my next question is, what would distinguish this day, this evening at 6 p.m. from any other day of the year when two people are standing in front of that particular residence? Are all of them subject to a Terry stop, an investigative detention?
I don't think that I can speak to hypotheticals. I mean, the point of the reasonable suspicion analysis is that it's based on the totality of the circumstances of our particular incident.
But counsel, based on everything that you've argued thus far, there's nothing about this particular incident that distinguishes it from any other group of people standing in that area. Your analysis thus far, as you have argued, consists of the fact that it was a high crime area, that it was an area based on the officer's experience is somewhere that has been used for drug activity, that based on his experience, an alleyway is often used for drug stashing and gun stashing. There's nothing about what you have argued that led to reasonable articulable suspicion in this case that is specific to either the defendant or the other two individuals that were in front of that were near in front of that house or in that alleyway on that day. So I think what Justice Alvin is asking is, based on your argument, it sounds like officers could have stopped anyone at any time doing anything in this particular neighborhood based on the arguments that you've made. Is that correct?
Thank you for clarifying. I think that the reason that defendant specifically was stopped was because he was the one who was coming out of the alleyway, specifically known based on this officer's training experience of where weapons and drugs are stashed. So if he saw two people standing in front of the same house known for drug activity in the same way, if he had reasonable suspicion to stop them and the circumstances were exactly the same, then I believe that he would have reasonable suspicion to do so. But the reason defendant specifically was stopped was because he was coming out of a known stash area and the officer believed, based on his training experience, that he was about to witness an imminent drug transaction between defendant and those two individuals.
You heard from your adversaries that walkway alleyway led to other residences. Do you concede that point or do you take issue with it?
That is what I understand. I think the most important part is that this particular house next to the walkway was known to be abandoned.
But assuming that the walkway led to other residences, and people were walking out of that residence onto the street, does that mean that anyone walking down that walkway would be subject to an investigative detention?
No, because this particular defendant was stopped based not only on that, but on the totality of the circumstances, including the officer's observation, training, defendant's conduct, and what he believed to be an imminent narcotics transaction.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Ms. Lamb?
Unless this court has any further questions, we ask that this court affirm the division of the
appellate. I have one question. Do you have access to that photograph that was made part of the record?
It was never made available to me, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Brooks, rebuttal?
I'll be brief. I just want to talk about the high crime area factor. It's clear. I mean, the first thing that the prosecutor talks about in her argument is that the reason that Mr. Goldsmith was stopped was because of the officer's beliefs about the area. This means that the nature of the area drove the stop. And the problem is that high crime area doesn't mean anything. It's not defined. What is high? What is crime? What is area? And this burden, the fact that high crime area is not defined, this burden falls disparately on the backs of Black and Brown communities. Other courts have begun to define this factor, and academics have long suggested that it should be defined. This court should take the opportunity to either define what it means or eliminate it. How it's currently used means that people in certain communities have lesser constitutional rights. This stop and frisk wouldn't have occurred in an area in Montclair. And as Justin Solomon asked, crime mapping is available in many jurisdictions. For instance, I cite an article, The High Crime Area Question, in my brief, and it collects jurisdictions that have high quality mapping technologies. So it's available, and this data can be very specific. It can map even something as small as a certain intersection. So the technology is there, and this factor can easily be defined with the four factors that I suggested. Cities are not monoliths. So this court, again, should take the opportunity in this case to ensure that the high crime area factor is defined so that other people, you know, some of them innocent and some of them guilty, are not stopped simply because of the area that they are in, the place where they live, or, you know, the places that they frequent. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We will take the matter.